Amen. Great to see you today. Today we get to look at what to me is one of the greatest stories in the Bible. It's the story of Joseph. Joseph, the guy who saved basically two civilizations, the Jewish people and the Egyptians. Either country would have sunk were it not for what he did. Lots of twists and turns in his story as well. It's so interesting and great to look at. But as we look at this story, I want to remind you of something that I'm sure you know, but maybe sometimes we don't think of. You know, a normal story that's made up, it's like very predictable, and the characters tend to be one-dimensional. In a fake story, the good guys are really good and the bad guys are really bad. The good guys wear white hats, bad guys wear black hats. There's no nuance according to who the people are because these are created characters. But when we read the Bible, these are real stories. This is actually history. It happened. And so as we look at Bible stories, we want to make sure that we don't reduce them to fake stories. We don't want to take a Bible story of history and then twist it. I mean, sometimes even today in the press, we do that with people. If somebody is someone that you like, they can do no wrong. If someone is somebody you don't like, they can do nothing right. But when it comes to Bible history, just like in real life, everyone has a reason for why they do what they do. And most people think they're doing the right things. And so if we reduce the complexity of the characters, we actually detract from the reality of the stories. And so when we read the Bible, we want to remember these are real people. When we look at the story of Joseph, it's really easy to just reduce the story to very simple characters. Jacob at this point is kind of a doddering old man, doesn't really know that much of what's going on. He foolishly didn't learn the lesson from his father and mother, and so he shows blatant favoritism toward one of his sons, which creates problems. You have Jacob's 10 older sons, Joseph's older brothers. Oh, they're just villains. They're just evil. They're jealous, they're mean and angry, and that's the way we see them, right down until the end when Joseph teaches them a lesson, and then they kind of reform, but we're not so sure whether their heart really changes. You have Benjamin, the 12th son. Benjamin is like a walk-on character, the way we see him. It's like, oh, he doesn't have any speaking parts or anything. He's just there as the youngest son. And then we have Joseph, the hero. He's great-looking. He's brilliant. He is his parents' favorite. And he, against all odds, you could put him anywhere, and he's just automatically successful. He has the Midas touch, and everyone in his life is just jealous of him. Now, if you see the characters this way, then the story unfolds, and it's kind of like the way that we always tend to brush through a story. But I want you today, I'd want to suggest at least, that you look at these not as characters in a story, but as people. And imagine who they are and what it was like for them and how they became who they were. See, when you're looking at this story, you are looking at a classic dysfunctional family for sure. Everything is a mess in their family. Huh? And some of you came from dysfunctional families, most of us probably. Many of us created our own dysfunctional families. But we can understand it's complex. And when you're saying whose fault is it, of course, first you look at Jacob. How did he let this happen? But when I look at Jacob and I try to go, oh, it's his fault, put yourself in Jacob's position. Jacob never wanted to be the head of this big thing. Jacob would have been perfectly happy just marrying the girl that he loves, having a couple of kids, and living happily ever after. But it didn't go that way for him. He found the girl that he loved, Rachel, and he's so excited, but then his uncle/father-in-law tricks him into marrying Leah first. He works 14 years to pay for two wives. If you're going to have two wives, that's bad enough. having them be sister wives, that's like even worse. And he didn't pick that. He loved Rachel. But there he was in that spot. And then his wives get in a baby-making contest, which in their culture was a big deal. Like, if you didn't have a baby, you were nothing. And so Leah, the ugly wife, starts cranking out babies. And she's got, you know, Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah. And Rachel's like, got nothing. So then Rachel comes to her husband and says, you know, if you love me, you'll sleep with my maid so that she can have kids and we'll just say they're my kids. And then Leah's like, well, I got a maid too. And so poor Jacob, all he wanted was a simple life. And he's stuck in this baby contest. And now he's got 12 kids that don't get along that well, a complicated life. He has, you know, he finally has this son, Joseph, where Rachel was the love of Joseph's, of Jacob's life. And she finally gets pregnant. And he's been listening to her moan and groan, I want a baby, I want a baby. And she finally has one. So, of course, and he figures, this is my last kid. You always kind of, the kid that comes along after the other kids, you sort of favor and baby him. You always say that you don't. But, you know, it's sort of a natural thing that would happen. But especially when it's like, he looks so much like his mom. She's great looking. The other kids, they're all like ugly, like their mom. And he's like this good looking kid. It's, I finally did something worthwhile. And he looks at it as, and then when he gets a spare, later Benjamin is born, and he has two of them. And he's like, this is all I ever wanted. Rachel, Joseph, Benjamin, we're good. Of course, unfortunately, Rachel dies during childbirth for Benjamin. And now Jacob is in the spot that we find him in this story. He just wanted a simple life, but it didn't go that way. Leah, what was it like to be Leah? Imagine that the only way you're going to get married is if somebody is tricked into marrying you. I mean, talk about messing with your self-esteem. And they say that so often women get their image of themselves from the way that their father values them and loves them. Imagine you're a girl. People are already saying, oh yeah, you're the uglier sister of Rachel, but you know, your dad doesn't look at you and say, oh, princess. He looks at you and says, I'm gonna have to trick somebody into marrying you. You carry that with you the rest of your life. Then you get married, you start having kids, you're like, this is gonna be great, but it's not great. One, two, three kids. Finally, when you have your fourth kid and your sister doesn't have any, you're like, okay, this is it. So you name that kid Judah, which means praise. It's like, finally, we've got our four kids. Rachel has none. It didn't work out so praiseworthy. It was just for the rest of her life, she felt like a second-class citizen. And she kind of lost her sister in the process because her sister was the one she was closest to. You know, when you're the uglier sister, you tend to look up to the better-looking sister, and now, oh no, this is really a mess. And she watches her kids that she loves not being appreciated, not being honored, being looked at as booby prizes in some way. Knowing that your kids that you love will always be kind of second-class citizens in that family. But imagine what it was like to be Rachel. You find the man that you love, and now you have to share him with your sister, losing your sister and half of your love life all in one swoop. You're struggling with fertility in a culture where that means everything, and you're feeling devalued and like a less of a woman. And I don't care if people say I'm good looking, but I feel horrible because I can't do what women were created to do. The humiliation of the only way you're going to come up with a kid is letting your husband sleep with your servant and saying, we'll say it's my kid. All of that surrogacy that would have in their culture just been, oh, that's awful. And then you finally have a son. You're like, yes, I've been waiting for this. But you watch your son being bullied by all of his older brothers, resented by him and by them and hated by them. Ultimately, her life ended short when, as she had her second child, she died and was buried. Of course, there are other characters in the story that I really feel for too. Bilhah and Zilpah, these two servant girls that, as far as they were concerned, they were hired to just take care of somebody. But they're actually hired to make babies, and ultimately those babies aren't even there. So they have kids. They watch their kids as part of this assortment of 12 brothers, and their kids were always third class. As we look at the story, one of the first things about Joseph is he saw the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah doing something wrong, and he ratted them out. Gives you the idea that their boys were considered even below. You have Joseph, then you have Leah's kids, then you have the servant girl's kids behind that. And can you imagine, for these two gals, the crazy job that they were hired to do, that they have to work for this nutty family, and their kids have to grow up there? But look at these 11 sons and imagine what it's like to be them. Reuben was the oldest. Normally when a boy is born first, oh man, that's such an honor. That means you're going to inherit a lot. Of course, if you have enough kids, it cuts down on your inheritance. But Reuben would be, yeah, the oldest. And for Leah, I gave him his firstborn. But Reuben always knew that he was the oldest from the mom who really wasn't appreciated or loved by the husband at all. Your mom isn't loved. Congratulations, you're her son. Imagine being Judah. You're fourth. You're called praise. It's kind of like the idea of, wow, now we're going. Now we're cranking. And so your name is praise, but the truth is when you're born, it doesn't change anything. Because a little while after that, they start getting other babies, and now your mom can't have a baby, and it would be tough being those guys. Imagine what the sons of the concubines had to go through. Then finally Benjamin is born, but he has no mom, and he's trying to live up to Joseph. Like, yeah, you're a spare. You're kind of a backup for Joseph, but why can't you be more like Joseph? And he's like, I'm just Benjamin, I don't know. But imagine if you're Joseph. It wasn't a picnic for him either. You know, he didn't choose to be Rachel's first child. But when he was born, you would think, I mean, like for any little boy who has big brothers, that's like the best. You know, if you get to grow up in a family of boys, you're the one that, you know, you're number 11. Now we have a whole football team. We're in great. But for him, it was never quite that way. They never really accepted him because it was kind of weird the way his dad treated him. It was kind of odd that he was special because of his mom being the wife that dad really wanted. So while they were probably going off to school and working and playing sports, and he's held back and homeschooled, had to wear a weird coat and Crocs, you know, and it's like he didn't choose that. It was just he got pushed into this weird life. And nobody was going to accept him, and yet here he was, himself with his dad. He was treated differently. There was no way that he was ever going to fit in. They had to resent him. You would. It was just, you couldn't help it. And so he felt different, and, you know, he was socially awkward for sure, walking around wearing this weird jacket and not hanging out with the other guys. And you can see through his story, he was pretty good, but he didn't know how to deal with people all that well. These are the real people that are involved in this story. And as we go through the story very quickly, let's remember, we can all relate to some things about some of these characters. These aren't pretend people. These are real people. So we pick up the story in chapter 37 of Genesis. And you can turn over there, and in verse 2, the kids of Bilhah and Zilpah, the two maids, were doing some goofing around, and Joseph ratted them out to his dad. Verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. Can't you imagine being one of those brothers? You didn't choose to not be Joseph. And you understand how, hey, dad just likes him better. He's not doing it intentionally. Hey, our mom is second class. That makes us second class. Our moms are slaves. That makes us slaves. But they would look at Joseph and be like, he's a reminder of everything we didn't get in life. And they resented him. But again, he has this dream. And he goes, hey guys, I had a dream. And we all, each of us had a big stalk of hay. And all of your stalks of hay bowed down to my stalk of hay. Isn't that weird? And they're like, there's nothing weird about it at all. What's weird is you were stupider. Tell us that story. Keep your dream to yourself. But he's like, you know, it's just a dream. Then he's like, and probably Jacob heard about it. And he's like, well, makes sense. He is my favorite. So then he has another dream, though, where he goes, hey, Dad, I had a dream. Sun and moon and 11 stars all bowed down to me. And Jacob's like, you're saying that your mom and I and your brothers are all going to bow down to you? He's like, it's just a dream. I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. And Jacob kind of kept it in his heart, but, you know, he kind of rebuked him for it, too. Well, sometime later, the brothers there in chapter 37 were out working in the fields with, they kept sheep, and as they were out herding the sheep, Jacob sent Joseph to go check on his brothers. Now, for Joseph, a guy like that who, when he saw his brothers doing something wrong, he would rat them out, they probably looked at that and were like, he's just going to go find something that we're doing wrong. And if you lived in that crazy family and you got out in the field, you'd kind of let your hair down and get kind of weird, you know. It's just you're out from under the cloak of these four women and this dad. And so they see Joseph coming and they're like, oh, great. He sends Joseph as a spy and he's going to come out here and find us doing something bad. So there in chapter 37, beginning with verse 19, they said to one another, look, the dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. Can't you understand how they might feel that way? He's out here to spy on us. We had a pretty good life, man. We were the boys. We were the 10 boys of Jacob till he was born. And now, not only are our moms disrespected, but we are disrespected by this dreamer. So as you read on in the story, though, Reuben, who was the oldest, and you got to give him credit, Reuben felt like, even though I'm not appreciated, I'm still the older brother and I have some responsibility here. So he goes, now let's not kill him. He goes, let's just throw him in a pit and leave him there. And so they're like, okay, fine. As you read the story, you find out Reuben planned on, we'll dump him in the pit, we'll leave, I'll come back, get him out of the pit, send him back to dad, and everything will be fine. But then it was lunch break, and the guys were eating, and Reuben was off somewhere checking on sheep. So they see these Ishmaelite traders coming through. And Judah goes, you know, there's no point in us killing him. I mean, he is our brother, kind of. And so he's like, let's just sell him into slavery, make a few bucks. So the Ishmaelites came and they sold him for 20 shekels of silver, about $200, pawned him off. Now Reuben comes back and he looks in the hold, ready to let, oh, what happened? And they're like, hey, we got, look, $200 for him. And he's like, this is going to kill dad. And I'm the older brother. He's going to hold me accountable. So Reuben, and as they're talking, they go, okay, get his stupid little coat and let's put a bunch of blood on it and just tell dad we found his coat out in the wilderness and he'll figure an animal killed him. So they do that. They go back. His dad's just devastated. But, you know, he is sold into slavery in Egypt and Jacob has lost his favorite son. Now, can you imagine what now life was like for Benjamin when you're like, you have to step up to the plate now and try to live up to who Joseph was, and now your brothers are really suspicious of you. They're afraid that you're going to find out. For them, they have this guilt. For Jacob, this just complete sadness that now not only is Rachel dead, what happened to my dreams? Joseph's dead as well. Well, he got sold into slavery, and chapter 38 gives a side story of Judah and Tamar just to show you that he was a mixed bag for sure and kind of a, you know, just irresponsible, and as we see there. But when we get to chapter 39, we find out Joseph was taken down to Egypt in verse 1, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. It goes on to say, Potiphar put him in charge of everything in the house. Potiphar is a military guy. He was going to be gone a lot, so he had a servant he trusted. This sharp teenage kid, you know, 18 years old or so by this time. And he put him in charge of everything. For Joseph, it was like, dang, this is better than being at home where I couldn't trust my brothers. I didn't know what they were going to do. You know, Joseph probably, when he was in the pit, he thought, come on, guys, quit messing around, you know. And then he's pulled out and he's like, oh, that was good. You had me going. And they're like, yeah, you're going. Sell him to slavery. And now he ends up being like a house leader for a wealthy guy. And he's like, this is way better than being at home. And here I'm independent, more or less, for a slave. But Potiphar had a wife. And we're hard on Potiphar's wife a lot of times, but you don't know how she became his wife, if he bought her. You don't know. I mean, she obviously was left alone a bunch because he would be off doing his job. And here's Joseph, this good-looking guy in the house. But at any rate, she starts hitting on Joseph every day. And he's probably at first kind of like, you know, this is naive about the whole thing. But then she's getting more insistent. Finally, she grabs a hold of him and said, lie with me. Come on, let's do this. Now, in the mind of a teenager, it's certainly like, oh, this sounds, you know, okay, Mrs. Robinson. But at the same time, you're like, man, if my boss finds out, I'm dead. I have it pretty good here. And he's explaining to her, no, man, your husband, trust me, I can't do this. And she's just trying to force him. And he just pulls out of his outer coat and takes off running. Now she's like, uh-oh. If he goes and tells Potiphar, Potiphar's probably going to believe him and have me killed. And plus, I'm embarrassed that I got desperate and I tried to do it with the slave and he wouldn't even have me. And he's this good-looking guy. And so she yells for help and says, ah, these Hebrews, they're trying to shame us. Look at you, Potiphar. You brought a Hebrew into our house, and these Hebrews are dirtbags. And he was trying to rape me and, you know, concocted this whole story. Joseph didn't really even defend himself. But somehow Potiphar, I think, knew that it was fishy because he normally, you'd just kill the guy that tried to attack your wife. But instead, he put him into prison. And as we read on in the story, the Lord was with Joseph in verse 21 and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his. It's like Joseph's going, I thought it was cool at Potiphar's house, but man, in prison, I'm the boss of all these people, and I feel safe. I don't have some, some older woman trying to come on to me and scam on me. I'm in jail, and this is going okay. And he's probably feeling pretty good. Meantime, back in Canaan, they're just like, oh, yeah, Joseph, poor Joseph. I wonder what he's doing. Probably nothing. Jacob's miserable. Joseph's, like, doing pretty good running the prison. In the next chapter, there are two guys that both worked for Pharaoh that got thrown in jail. Pharaoh, if he'd just get mad at you for any reason, he would throw you in jail for a while, and that's what he did. One of them was called the butler, but that means he was a cupbearer. His job basically was when the Pharaoh was thirsty, he would get some wine, and the butler would taste it, and if he didn't die, then Pharaoh would drink it. Great job. Then there was a baker who just made you know, sidecar donuts for the Pharaoh. So these two guys, he got mad at them one day and threw them both in jail. They're in jail, and Joseph's in charge of jail. So one day they looked really sad, and he goes, "What's your problem?" And, you know, again, in this story, we start to see Joseph's not real smooth with people, but he asks them what was wrong, and they go, "Oh, we both had bad dreams last night. We don't know what's going on." He goes, "Well, tell me the dream. Maybe I know what it means. I've had dreams before myself." So the cupbearer goes, "I had a dream, and there were these three branches coming off a grapevine. And all these succulent grapes were squeezed into the glass, and I was giving Pharaoh the glass of this fresh wine." And Joseph goes, "Oh, that's easy. The three branches are 3 days. And in 3 days, Pharaoh's going to come get you out of jail, and you're going to be back serving him. You're back in the money." And he goes, "When you do, put in a good word for me, because I don't really belong in here. These were trumped up charges." The guy's like, "Hey, if in 3 days I'm out, trust me, I will tell." Then at that point, the baker is like, "Oh, good, this sounds, I want to, what's mine?" And again, Joseph's not very smooth with them. He hasn't just been around people that much. And so he's like, "Oh, what's your dream?" And he goes, "I dreamed I had 3 baskets on my head, all these donuts in the baskets." It's like, "Whoa, this is sounding similar." But he goes, "Then birds are coming in and eating the donuts. What does that mean?" And Joseph's like, "Oh, that's easy. In 3 days, Pharaoh's going to cut your head off and hang you, and then the birds are going to eat your flesh." And he's like, "Wait, why does he?" "I don't know, man. I just interpret the dreams. It's not my, you know." So sure enough, 3 days later, the butler gets out. He's back with the Pharaoh. The baker's hanging there with birds eating his flesh. And sadly, it says that at this point, Joseph's thinking, "Wow, when are they going to show up to let me out? Because I'm sure that the cupbearer, he's a close advisor to the king, he's going to let me out." But he forgot, it said. He just totally forgot about the whole deal. And there in verse 23. So all of this happened. Now, years were going by while this was going on, till we get to chapter 41. You know, the last verse of chapter 40, "Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Now, when Joseph started all this, he was a teenager. By now, he's 30. We don't know how long he was with Potiphar. We don't know how long he was in jail. But this is some prime time of his life. And when chapter 41 comes along, the Pharaoh has a couple of dreams, and they're really bugging him in chapter 41. And the Pharaoh's like, "I had these dreams, and I don't know what they mean." And he brought in all the magicians and psychologists and everybody, and they just weren't able to interpret the dreams. So then the butler is like, "You know, I just remembered something. Remember years ago when you were all mad at me and threw me in jail along with the baker, and then you killed the baker and you got me out? There was a guy in there who told me exactly what was going to happen. I bet he could interpret your dream." So Pharaoh's like, "Okay, bring him out here." So they got Joseph out of jail. He got all cleaned up. He shaved because the Egyptians hated facial hair. And he comes before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's like, "I had these dreams. And, you know, could you interpret them?" And he said in chapter 41 of verse 16, Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, "It's not in me, but God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." So he goes, "Okay, I dreamed there were these 7 really healthy cows, and they were, you know, eating grass and everything. And then there were these 7 ugly, skinny, little pathetic cows who came out of the river, and they ate the healthy cows. And that was it. But I had this other dream where there were these 7 big stalks of wheat, really healthy and succulent. And then there were these 7 all rotten, miserable stalks of wheat, and they came and ate the good ones." What's it mean? Joseph goes, "Oh, that's easy. It's the same. Each one is the same dream, basically. What's going to happen is you're going to have 7 years of prosperity. And then after that, you're going to have 7 years of poverty, famine. drought. And he goes, I'm just making a suggestion. You should find somebody really smart, wink, wink, and put him in charge, and he needs to run everything. And what he should do is jack up taxes to 20% of everyone's income. Can you imagine? I mean, paying 20% tax? But he's like, he can do that for 7 years, and he can collect everything. And then during the 7 years of drought and famine, you guys will control all of the food. And actually what ended up happening is everyone ends up owning their soul to the government. Because in order to get food, they had to give up their land, their houses, their cattle, and ultimately their freedom. And so almost the whole country became slaves. But he goes, so do that. And the Pharaoh's like, I think I will put you in charge of this. I think you seem like the perfect guy. And so Pharaoh put Joseph in charge of everything. He made him second command. Now, when you think about it, it's kind of amazing. Because to predict 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of drought, you'd kind of like, wait, I don't know if this is going to happen or not. But he believed him. There was something about Joseph that just seemed like, this kid's weird, but he seems to know something. And so he gave him nice clothes, gold chains, gave him his ring, gave him his second chariot, so his backup wheels are now Joseph's. People had to bow down to him. They had to do whatever he said. He married a pagan priest's daughter, and at this point, he's 30 years old. What a life. He's been away from his family for almost half of his life, but he's just dealing with it. He's plugging along. It seems like whenever something bad happens, something good happens. And we see his attitude when he had two kids and named them. Look at chapter 41, verses 50 through 52. And to Joseph were born two sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. Manasseh means forget it. For God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. He's like, I don't even remember any of that. That was kind of miserable anyway compared to now, obviously. His second son he named Ephraim, which means fruitful. He had this optimism, forgetting the past, and an optimism toward things are going to get really good and fruitful in the future. Well, in chapter 42, Jacob comes back into the picture, and he's like, the 7 years had passed, and now they're like running out of grain. And he hears that they have grain in Egypt. So he gets his boys together, and he says, go down to Egypt and buy some grain. And they go, the 10 older brothers went. Benjamin didn't go because now he's the little protected kid at home. But the 10 other brothers head down there. Joseph sees them and he's like, whoa, this is weird. They didn't recognize Joseph because, let's face it, he was a teenager when he left and now he's 37, 38, something like that. But also those Egyptians wore a ton of makeup, globbed all over him, so probably wouldn't have recognized him anyway. And even though he could understand Hebrew, he spoke Egyptian in front of them. He began to accuse them. Where are you guys from? You're just here to spy on us. And he's really giving them a hard time and messing with them. Now, you can understand why he might relish that a bit, but it also seems like he's just testing them because this goes on for a while. He doesn't know who they are. They might be the same guys, and they might even, when they see that it's him, they may get mad at him and yell at him or go, figures, look at you. First you're a dreamer, now you're second command in Egypt. Boy, you really think you're something, don't you? So he conceals his identity, and then he says, and they're like, no, we have 12 brothers, although one of them is dead, and we have another little brother who's at home, and there's us 10, and our dad sent us here. And later on, Jacob's like, why did you tell him you had another brother? That was stupid. But Jacob's like, okay, so he sells them grain, and then he has his servants take the money and put it back in their sacks when they're not looking. But he says, I want to meet that younger son to know you're telling the truth. So I'm going to take this guy, and he picks Simeon, the second oldest, goes, I'm going to lock him up, and you want to get your brother back, you'll bring back the little brother. So they head out. They go home. As they're on their way home, they notice, oh, shoot, our money is in our sacks. They messed up somehow. They're going to think we stole it. Now we lost our brother. So they come back to their dad, and they're like, Dad, we have to take Benjamin down there. Oh, and by the way, we got this extra money. And, you know, but Simeon's going to die. And Jacob is, no way. I lost Joseph. Now I've lost Simeon. I'm not going to lose little Benjamin. But gradually, they had to do something. They were out of food. They were starving. So he called them together, and he said, okay, go back. And they're in chapter 43. They sent him back with a bunch of gifts, a bunch of nuts and trinkets and things like that, Holy Land souvenirs, and sent him back down there with Benjamin, double the money, and, you know, they're nervous, but they're like, well, maybe this will be fine, maybe this will work out. And when Joseph saw them, he was like choked up. So he sent somebody out to greet him, told him, hey, my master wants to have a special meal with you guys. And they're like, oh, shoot. He knows about the extra money. He's going to kill us. And Simeon's probably already dead. But then Simeon comes out. They talk to the servant as they're setting up the meal, which weirdly, their seats were in the order of their age. And they're like, that's weird. But obviously, Joseph knew who they were. They told the servant, hey, just want to, we need to give some money back. And the guy's like, eh, don't worry about it. I put that in your sack. Don't worry. So they set up this meal, and they eat dinner, and Benjamin has five times as much food as everyone else, which is kind of cool that the child's plate is bigger than all the others. But, you know, so they get through this. Joseph still doesn't reveal himself, but he sends them off, but he put their money back in their sacks, and this time he told somebody, take my chalice, my personal chalice, and put it in the backpack of the younger kid. And so they did. They move on down the road and realize, oh no. And then here comes some soldiers from Egypt. Somebody stole the chalice, and the older brothers are like, hey man, go ahead. If somebody has your chalice, take him as your prisoner. And then it's Benjamin. And Judah is like, they go back with him. And Judah says, look, you know, I can't let my brother stay here and die. It'll kill my dad. Let me stay here. And you send him off. And Joseph was like, wow, I can't believe Judah is sticking up for my little brother. Before that, he had heard the story of how earlier it wasn't just universal to send him off, and that his oldest brother Reuben had really tried to rescue him, and that touched him as well. Now these guys are scared to death, and Joseph's like, maybe there's some good in these guys. And he just begins to cry, and he dismisses everyone other than the brothers, and then he called them in and revealed himself to them, and he said, go get Dad. Tell him I'm still alive, and bring him and everybody else from there up here. And so through the rest of the book, Jacob got to come, be reunited with Joseph. He was amazed. Not only he got Benjamin back, but he got Joseph, and here's all his sons together, kind of what he always hoped would happen. The brothers are still kind of nervous. You know, when they found out you're Joseph, but he told him, hey, don't worry about it. He said, God sent me before you to preserve life in chapter 45 and verse 5 and verse 7. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you. And later in verse 5 in chapter 50, after his dad died and they thought now we're dead, he goes, you meant it for evil, but God intended it for good. And they're like, could this even be real? This is crazy. And they were so, you know, they felt horrible about the way they had treated him, but there's a reason why they did. Now, finally, Jacob got the family that he always wanted. all of them together. Everything from the past is put behind them. And they all lived kind of happily ever after until years and years later, their ancestors or their descendants all became slaves in Egypt. And that leads to the Exodus, where Moses ultimately led them out. But what lessons are there in the story for us? First of all, life is complicated. There are always twists and turns and weird things that you don't see coming. Life is that way, but God is always working. Now, I don't believe that everything bad that someone does is because God made them do it, because then God would be held responsible. But God is a specialist at untangling our messes. It's what Paul says in Romans 8:28. God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. This story is just an amazing example of how God takes a messed up, you know, dysfunctional family and people who have become products of that dysfunction and those who are victims of circumstance. And he's like, I can work all that and look what I can produce. But when we look at the life of Joseph, I think there are several qualities that are not only admirable to go, wow, Joseph was something, but there are things we can appropriate in our lives as well. One of the first and the most central is accept the things in life that you can't change. This is ultimately, if you look at where you are right now and what your life is like right now, you have a choice. You can either look at it and say, no. You can look at it and go back and blame other people. You can have, oh, why didn't I do this? And what if I did that? Joseph was like, I'm in a ditch. Okay, now what do? I'm being sold as a slave. Okay, now I'm becoming a slave. You know what he did when he was a slave? He worked his tail off to be the best slave that he could possibly be. He didn't sit there and moan and groan about it. He didn't take his own life. He didn't try to get a lawyer and argue his way out of it. He just like, okay, I will accept this reality, and I'm going to work hard to do whatever I can do to make the best of my reality. People if there's a likelihood of your life ever getting better, it's probably in direct proportion to how fiercely you will accept that it is what it is. This is the way life is right now. How can I make the most of these circumstances that I'm in? Forgetting the past. Let the past be past. You can't change what you did before. It really doesn't even do you any good to meditate on all the reasons that got you where you are, because you are not a good interpreter of your own history anyhow, and you can't change history. So if we're going to make the best of now, we have to let go of the past. Like the Apostle Paul said, I forget what lies behind, and I reach forward to what lies ahead. And Joseph is like an amazing example of doing that. And that's why he names his first son, Forget About It. He's like, man, the past is past. But his second son, he believes that he is fruitful, that good things are going to come. So when you combine a forgiveness of the past, forgetting that, and at the same time, a confidence in the future, a belief, a conviction that things can get better, and I'm going to do everything I can to cooperate with God to actually make this better. Bitterness about the past, and a discouragement and fear and worry about the future will destroy the present. It does every time. And here's why. If you are resentful about the past, if you can't get over the past, what you're basically saying is, God screwed up. God messed this up. He didn't do what he needed to do, and now here I am, a victim of God failing to do what he should have done. Now, how do you think that feels to God? Wait, I did this? I don't know what I'm doing? But worry and, you know, an anticipation of gloom and doom, anxiety about the future, is saying, I think God's not going to get it right. I don't think God's going to do what he ought to do. So guess what kind of life you get when you have a God who messed up the past for you and a God who's not going to take care of the future for you. You end up in the present hopeless. You end up just taking on a victim mentality, remaining where you are, and things will get worse. Because if you don't have faith and hope, you will not move forward. And if you can't accept what it is now, you can't be free to move into the future. But Joseph is a guy who's like, he wasn't going to let the past determine who he was. And he was going to believe that the future would get better. And in fact, that's what happened. We also see in his forgiveness a good principle that when you forgive somebody, it doesn't mean you trust them. You can trust, but verify. And he took his brothers through these things, not because he wanted to punish them, but because he just really wanted to see if he could trust them. If someone burned you, it would be foolish for you to say, okay, I forgive you, and then set yourself up to let them burn you again. There need to be tests. There need to be, you have to be intelligent about who you will trust and what that means. Give them an opportunity to prove themselves for sure. But at the same time, don't set yourself up just to be a sucker as well. Now, when I look at all the people in this room, most of you, some of you I know parts of your story, but there's almost no one in here who I know your whole story. Your story is all of what happened, the dysfunction, the bad breaks, the mean things that people did, the things you were victimized of. I don't know what happened in the past that made you who you are right now, but we all have our stories. And sometimes we're even uncomfortable thinking about stories because it's like, I've been trying to put that out of my mind. But every one of us is who we are for a reason. And I'm not sure what your whole story is, but what I know is God knows exactly what brought you right to where you are right now. And he has been working in your story, and he desires to bless you and bring you forward and to give you a better life than you ever planned or imagined for yourself. That's the way God is. He wants to give you a great future. But you have to start now, accepting the reality of now. You have to let go of what's behind you, and you have to believe that God's going to do good things in the future. Your future will be taken care of. You just have to trust him. Let go of the past and forgive anyone that needs to be forgiven, not for their sakes, but for yours. We don't forgive people for them. We forgive people so that they don't live in our heads with free rent for the rest of our life. So we go, that's past, because I don't want to be living with that. But believe in a future. Believe in a God who can take you from wherever you are right now. If you feel like you are a slave, if you feel like you're in a family that's destroying you, relationships, employment, everything else that's just making you miserable, welcome to Joseph's life. Start here. Accept the reality. Can you work as hard as you can possibly work in your current situation? And then believe that God's going to honor that work and that labor. Believe in the future because you believe in God. Make the most of right now. Now, if you're somebody who has never really given your life to Jesus, he would love to meet you. But although he's been following your story, and he's actually been watching you mess your life up so that he could come in at some point and turn it around for you. He loves you. He always has. He gave his son to die for you so that you could have a real life. But if you've never given him permission to work in your life, I'd suggest you start there. If your life is a mess, start with him, and you'll find out it's not as much of a mess as you thought. He intends everything that you've done and everything that's happened for good. If you'll buckle down now, deal with reality, believe in him, let go of the past, he wants to work in your life. And one way to let go of the past is to ask God to forgive your sins, to give you a fresh start. If you've never done that, there'll be people down here in front who would love to pray with you. You can start life over today. And I pray that you would do just that. He loves you, he wants to forgive you. Make it right with him. If there's anything in your life that's just causing you to, this is dragging me down, come down, let somebody pray for you and get rid of it. dump it. Don't get sucked into bitterness and resentment and a lack of hope in the future and let that wreck now. You need to get busy. You need to get to work because there's a great life that God has for you. And every bad thing that you've done and every bad thing that's ever been done to you is he makes it a part of his plan. He goes, I'm going to turn that into something good. So if you need prayer, come on down and get prayer. But for all of us this week, let's just be just completely honest about our life, about where it is right now. If you understand how it got there, fine, think about that. But at any rate, the important thing is, here's where I am. Here's my family. Here's my work. Here's my health. Here's my age. Here's my life. Accept it. And then get busy making the most of the opportunities that God has given you. And if you do that, there are great reasons to have hope and confidence and joy moving forward. Let's pray. Lord, thank you that when we're way off in Egypt, victims of our own bad decisions, I'm sure there were times when Joseph just thought I should have kept the dreams to myself, victims of other people who can't deal with who we are and because of it they take it out on us, victims of an unfair system, of an economy of slavery. But we come to you now, knowing that none of these things stops you from wanting to take us right from where we are, in all of its ugliness and all of its reality, and move us forward to a beautiful place. We submit our lives to you to do that. We want to deal with real. If there's anybody here who doesn't know you, help them to realize they can come down, receive the forgiveness of sins, be adopted by you, and then you will meet them in their slavery, in their prison, in their loneliness, and in their pain. Make them your children, Lord, and draw them to a life of hope and joy. Help them to do that today. And help all of us to live like that's happened to us. In Jesus' name, amen.